20th Century Rock presents Mr. K's Super Show, where a trivial mind is a terrible thing to waste. Welcome to Mr. K's Super Show. I'm Chris Karam, a.k.a. Chris Karam. Today, we're going to go back in time, 50 years ago, in fact, to when the first Kiss album was released. But Kiss didn't release just one album that year. They released two, so therefore, we're going to cover both of those albums on this episode. But we're going to do it a little differently this time. Normally, I would have someone on and we'd talk about both albums, or I would have two people on and we'd have a three-way discussion. I'm going to discuss each album with a different person, and to make it even more interesting, these are people who've never been on the show before, so we're very excited. So let's go on to the first album, but before we do that, a message from our sponsor.
You must remember this, a kiss is just a kiss, but this one's something else, sweetheart. Kiss, baby. Introducing the kiss that gets you, angel. Kiss, a new group, a new album on Casablanca Records.
We're here to talk about Kiss's first album, which was released 50 years ago. Yep, 50 years ago, folks. In order to do that, I wanted to bring somebody on who knows what he's talking about, but yet at the same time has never been on the show before. He is the co-host of the Cobras and Fire podcast. Baco, welcome to the show.
Yeah, you wanted to have someone on that knew what they were talking about, but had to settle for me. Thanks for having me on the show. That's what I really mean to say.
Well, you know, your salary requirements were easily met.
no doubt.
You know, I mean, you should see, like, people like Brad Page, they just hold me up for all sorts of money, and I keep...
As he should, yeah.
But I keep telling him I don't have any money. But anyway, yeah, 50 years ago, I mean, this is...
Now you sound like a Kiss fan. You don't have any...
What's that?
You don't have any money because you're a Kiss fan and you just,
I spent all that money.
Oh, God.
You know, yeah. It's true. Kiss will drain your bank account, your wallet, and sometimes your goodwill.
You're not wrong.
No. But anyway, so like I said, this album came out 50 years ago. Baco, what was your experience with it? When did you first discover it? And what did you think of it at the time?
You know, it probably seemed like a lot longer from when I first got into Kiss to where I actually heard this record than it was. But, you know, everything seemed longer back then. So I got into Kiss in December 1977, early December, late November, something like that, through my sister. And it was probably the following summer. It was like I had a friend in school. Him and I were Kiss fans, and then my sister. So between the three of us, we had most of the records. So at some point at his house, I heard this. You know, we would get together and play Kiss albums. It's kind of how we hung out. But so, yeah, the summer of 78, probably.
Yeah, I know for me, I got into Kiss in 77, but I didn't see this album in stores until around January of 78. And so, of course, when I saw it, I'm like, well, I got to have it. It's a Kiss album I don't have. And what was interesting was that I realized now that what I bought was an actual repressing or a reissue because It had the Casablanca Record and Filmworks label with the palm trees and all that stuff, you know, which is probably my favorite out of all of them. Whereas the original first pressing actually had the blue Smoking Man Humphrey Bogart Casablanca label. And of course, what's interesting about the very first pressing is that Kissin' Time was not on it. So an album that like is already short to begin with is like not even a half hour long. I think it's something like 27 or 28 minutes without Kissin' Time. Well, of course, you know the story about Kissin' Time where it was recorded to tie in with a kissing contest, and Neil Bogart assured them, oh, don't worry, we won't put it on any of your albums or anything. This is just a one-off single. Well, of course, Casablanca broke off from Warner Brothers Records, who was distributing them, and they had to repress all their albums. So, of course, they put Kissin' Time on that album, but It's kind of weird. I almost have a hard time imagining that record without Kissin' Time. It just seems like something's missing because that's the way I heard and didn't realize that for years.
Same. Yeah. I'm not sure when I first heard it. I mean, fairly early on, I knew like before they took the makeup off that there was a version that supposedly existed. I didn't see one until the one I actually own, and that would have been in the mid 90s. But I ran across it a couple times since. But yeah, my friend and I, we always called it the blue label, the Bogart label, and then there's the desert and the Filmworks. But I remember as a kid, I really preferred the label you're talking about. But over the years, I've kind of got nostalgic for that classic Casablanca blue label. I do dig it a lot. So.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that, like, whenever I see a Casablanca label or a logo, I get nostalgic. That, like, nostalgia button just gets pushed. It takes you back because it takes me back to a time when I had no responsibilities, no real worries, and all my life was about Kiss albums, TV shows, and comic books. But when you go back to this album, I mean, this was produced by Kenny Kerner and Richie Wise, and it's interesting is that Kiss was a hard rock band, but yet this was not hard rock production. These guys were pop producers, as I understand it. And I'm guessing that I think they worked with Neil Bogart before when he was at Buddha Records, and they probably came fairly cheaply too, because Casablanca did not have a lot of money at this time.
Yeah, definitely. And even less than a shortly after they launched, when they kind of broke from Warner Brothers. But yeah, the production, to me, I think it's weird that they also produced the next record, and I can't think of a production team producing two back-to-back records that sound more drastically different than this record and Hotter Than Hell. So that's a little weird. I don't know if it has to do with the setting and the timing, but or maybe they tried to get Kiss a little heavier once they realized what they were dealing with.
What you just said is actually the truth. They realized that Kiss was a heavy metal or a hard rock band, so they tried a different approach, but these guys were not hard rock producers. So what they thought was a hard rock production sound, one of them even admitted later on that they messed up. They just did not know how to. Yeah, they actually admitted it. Like,
I
yeah,
love
we
that
screwed up.
album though. I love the production. I get the criticism and why people have that. I'm not discounting that, but I think I know we're here to talk about Kiss, but the Hotter Than Hell is I think it's them organically their heaviest. You know what I mean? We're creatures that kind of went in with the direction we are going to do this, but this was just them. They went in, and to me, this I think Hotter Than Hell is their darkest, heaviest record naturally.
Well, Hotter Than Hell is also different because they recorded it at a different studio, like in California, the Village Recorder in Los Angeles. So these two guys are in a studio they're not familiar with. These guys are New York guys. They're trying a different approach. And, the one thing that redeems Hotter Than Hell for me is the performances. They're young. They're hungry and they want to grab you by the scruff of the neck and say, "Listen to us." That's what keeps it from being like a dud. But you go back to this album. If you listen to the Kiss box set, they have these studio run-throughs for the engineers that were recorded like at the same time. But those versions are a lot more raw, more in your face, and heavier. Whereas you can tell, I don't want to say they homogenize them, but they kind of put them through like a they polish them a little bit. It's a bit more like watered. I don't want to say watered down, but it's more straightforward. It's not, they're not really distorting the guitars. This isn't like a Bob Ezrin production, obviously.
Yeah, there's not a lot of gain on the guitars compared to what they would use basically going forward. But yeah, it does to me sound like a really polished kind of like demo setting. It's unfortunate that it doesn't have that kind of because bands have had those like the first Black Sabbath record to me still sounds amazing.
Yes.
And
Oh, yeah.
that was recorded at a time earlier than this on probably a budget about the same, if not smaller, and it probably faster than this one was. So it's unfortunate they couldn't capture something like that, but there it's still because it definitely sounds different than the versions that we've heard of most of these songs, like on Kiss Alive.
These are almost like demo, like you said, these are like demos for Kiss Alive, because the Kiss Alive versions are mo a lot more heavier, fleshed out. Of course, you got Eddie Kramer behind the, engineering desk. I mean, he was the mobile truck, so that's a big difference.
And all
I know
the
we're sidetracking here. I don't think Kiss Alive is as overdubbed as people think it is. I've heard some of the raw audio. Yeah,
overdubs.
you can hear some bits where the guitar is out of tune or there's a fluff note. I think, I think people like to punch up their own egos by saying, "Oh, we had to o re-record the whole thing in the studio." Either way, I don't care. It's a great album.
Oh, me either. It's a classic. I mean, it sounds so good. If they recorded the whole thing, bravo. It's amazing. It's weird too, because we're hearing this record the first time. That's the first time you really cleanly limited budget for stereo for Baco as a little grade schooler. But
Same.
But the first time you really hear that kind of drug out kind of chord on Deuce, because it really doesn't punch through on the live version. So that was kind of neat, but I was like, God, I like the live version a lot better. But I do actually like the intro to Deuce on the studio version better than the live version. I kind of like that. It just kind of grooves a little bit.
Do 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 do. Whereas like on Alive, it's like da 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 da. You know,
Yeah.
of course, you know they had to get, you know, get a sample of a cannon going off because you've
Yeah.
ever heard an actual like flash pod or a concussion bomb recorded. It does not record right.
Right,
It
yeah.
does something to the microphone. It like does something to the air or on a microphone. It actually sounds more like somebody set off I don't know, like a t tiny little explosion. But anyway.
Yeah, it almost goes deaf. It stops recording it. It's like,
Yeah, but you know, getting back to the first Kiss album, and that's okay. We sidetrack on this show, and that's one thing about, you know, you've been hosting a podcast for years. Sidetracking is like part of the deal. If you don't sidetrack,
Yeah.
it almost doesn't feel right. But you know, you can tell they were a little tone deaf at Casablanca by releasing "Nothing to Lose" as the first single. Now, at the time, I just took it for what it was worth. I heard about the back door. I didn't know. I literally pictured Gene walking in a back door to visit his girlfriend or having an illicit affair. I mean, even at that, I was only 11, but even then, I kind of had an idea, but I didn't realize he was talking about anal sex. Of course,
Yeah, it
like,
was a
you
long
know,
time before I knew, but yeah.
yeah, well, you know, then the following year, never mind, I can't talk about it. No, but yeah, it's a lot of that stuff sailed over my head back then. The only thing
Oh,
that
yeah. Yeah.
I got was when I heard "She" for the first time, and it's like she takes off her clothes, and I was like. You know, I was giggling because it, you know. But other than that, like Room Service, you know, like I literally thought Room Service was a song about Paul Stanley getting a cheeseburger delivered.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm trying to think. I know that I definitely didn't break things down. I've often talked about how if parents went after this kind of stuff the wrong way, if you ask me, because there is a very you don't want your 10-year-old kid listening to this stuff, not because they're satanic and they're gonna turn them into your kid into a devil worshiper, because these lyrics are going to stunt them their sexual maturity as they grow forward.
Oh,
They
God, yeah.
don't need to be hearing this stuff. There's a valid parental reason to shelter your kid from this, and they went the wrong way. They're like, Satan.
If you try to shelter your kids in an obvious way, that just makes them want to listen to it more.
Sure.
When I, you know, back in the 80s, we've talked about this on the show before. Back in the 80s, they had the Satanic Panic. All of a sudden, if you play Led Zeppelin 4 backwards, Stairway to Heaven, you know, I pray to my Lord Satan. And we discuss this a lot at the Black Mass I go to every week, at the Church of Satan. I'll tell you one thing though, the music is much better. I mean, you walk in, every Sunday they have Sabbath services. They literally play Black Sabbath. But you
That's
know,
my kind of church, man.
well, you know what they say, if I'm going to hell, at least I know the music's going to be better.
No, you would think so, but it was you know what? Music was definitely better when we were worried about Satan being part of it, you know? So.
And it's funny because even back then I knew it was bullshit. It was like you know, I knew there was just nervous Nellies trying to stir up controversy, but getting back to Nothing to Lose, what's interesting is that Peter Criss, he doesn't quite have his voice where it would be even later on in the record. I mean, he's doing this kind of like soul voice, you got nothing to lose. Like he's trying to be Mr. Smooth, whereas on Black Diamond, you know, you can hear that raspy husky voice that he became known for.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I actually think he's the most, I think he comes across as the most versed singer, like an experienced singer, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I do kind of get what you're saying. I think he was still trying to find his voice in Kiss a little bit, but Gene and Paul sound a lot younger than Peter does on this. And he also has kind of that R&B background, so I get a little bit of that. But yeah,
Yeah.
he definitely, Black Diamond really kind of showcases the vocal we would typically get from Peter going forward, where that, you got nothing to do. This is kind of a little
You got nothing
creepy.
to lose. Yeah, baby. Yeah. I picture him like he's like singing this to some, he's talking to some girl, like he's trying to pick her up. But you know, Peter Criss was older than them. He actually was significantly older than them. So, you know, he was almost 30 at this point, whereas they were in their early to mid 20s. So, you know, and plus you said he had that R&B, the jazz background, you know, playing like, but you know, at the same time, we know he liked rock and roll. We know he liked the Stones and the Beatles. So, he brought an interesting dynamic to it. Peter Criss was not your typical rock drummer. Back then, man, I'm telling you, people like to rag on him because of his skills and how they've diminished over the years, which is true. But back then, he played rock, but with like that swing.
He is the Kiss drummer in my book. And by people, you mean Paul Stanley.
Well, yeah, Paul and Gene. Paul Gene.
Oh man, Paul in his book says so much shit about Peter that it's just like, come on, just stop being mean. It's like, he doesn't know what a chorus is, but there's videos out there where they're like rehearsing and Paul's like, let's start from the chorus, and Peter seems to know where they're at, so I don't know.
Well, the thing about like Paul in his book, I give him credit. He craps on everybody.
Oh yeah, no, he's
He
equal
craps on Eric.
opportunity.
He craps on Eric Carr. He craps on Bruce Kulick. I mean, he crew up. He probably craps on Bruce Kulick the least, or Eric Singer the least.
Yeah.
He craps on Gene. I mean, he claims like at the end of his book, "Oh, I'm a so much more well-adjusted person, and I'm happier now." Bullshit.
No, therapy didn't work for Paul.
No, if anything, that's an argument against therapy.
Yeah, no kidding. God, he's probably more bitter.
Well, and those guys are going to be bitter to the end of their days. But, back in these days, whatever differences they had, it's like they said, when they walk in together, there's that chemistry, there's that X factor. You start off with Strutter with that, iconic drum intro. And like nobody plays those Kiss songs like Peter Criss did.
Right.
I mean, Eric Carr was great, Eric Singer was great, but neither one of them could play with that feel.
Agreed. Yeah, no.
That's not a knock. It's just different stuff. Eric Singer and Eric Carr were more straightforward, John Bonham type drummers. Or,
Right.
again, that's what made Kiss Kiss. Ace is kind of sloppy, that almost bordering on the edge of going off a cliff sloppiness, but yet never really falling apart completely.
I think he's a lot tighter during his run with Kiss than say reunion after. Yeah, and I know he's got this kind of loose style, but he's actually pretty tight, and his timing is really good. And yeah, he can yeah he from all accounts, it seems like for the most part he did go in there and nail the solos on one or two takes. So I mean, it wasn't like, let me do it 500 times and I'll get it good enough. You know what I mean? So he had it.
Well, I think in those days he wasn't quite as chemically impaired as I understand it. He really didn't start getting into the hard stuff until probably Hotter Than Hell or around that period. So, they were just drinking at this time and probably taking speed or whatever, but it didn't seem to
Yeah.
impair them. Whereas, Gene and Paul are like, oh no drugs, no alcohol, except for Gene, eating a hash brownie by accident, but. But you can hear. I mean, you've got Ace's first song, and I love how later on Paul and Gene tried to take credit for Cold Gin. Ace just came in with some riffs and some raw stuff, and we shaped it into a song. Yeah, all bands do that. You know what it's called? Arranging.
Yeah, no shit.
All artists come to the studio like with a rough demo, and what happens is the song gets fleshed out in the rehearsal process. Things get worked out. Hey, what if we tried this? Or what if we put this bridge here? Like Bob Ezrin, he listens to a song and he'll say, okay, bridge goes here. So, that's called arranging. And obviously Ace had like a song on pretty much every Kiss album, except for I think Destroyer. And then, he would sing, but he wouldn't want to sing because he was just too scared to sing. So, Gene did it. Gene. And you realize now how ridiculous it is Gene singing a song about drinking cold gin.
All right.
He's probably
Yeah,
never
yeah.
had gin in his life.
It's disgusting, by the way. I would never advise anybody drink cold gin.
I mean, then you get like Firehouse, which Paul actually admitted was kind of inspired by a song called Fire Brigade. That's the one I give Paul credit for. He admits where he steals. I mean, he gets his influences from.
Yeah, Gene says Deuce was from Bitch from the Rolling Stones. I think that's where he claimed that he just kind of reworked that dead
He just kind of switched a couple of notes. I can kind of hear it. I'm like, yeah, but it's not to the point where like when you listen to it, you go, oh, it's a ripoff. It's got its own.
No, it's the borderline of inspiration and plagiarism, but no, it's a commonplace. A lot of times you do that just to kind of get yourself out of writer's block or to kind of flush something out. You're writing a melody for something musically you like, but the melody you come up with is just shit. So you just go listen to something else and try to plop it on and then rework it and see if that helps. There's all sorts of ways you can You can borrow from other people without stealing, I guess is all I'm gonna
Or as David Lee Roth put it, steal from the best.
have.
But yeah, you're right. Everybody, if everybody got sued for something that was borrowed or inspired by, nobody would write songs. Maybe that's why people don't write songs anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, we're kind of there, but I think the line isn't as fine as some people like to talk. Not that we're here to talk about songwriting stuff, but it does seem like we're getting to that point where now we almost just it's okay. Who cares? I think it does matter, man. Inspiration means somebody inspired you to go do something, not monkey see, monkey do.
Right.
And there, I think it's a little more easy to split than some people try to make it seem like, oh, everything's already been done. Well, not really. I
No.
don't know.
Well, there's a difference between something that's derivative and that's a ripoff.
There you
A
go.
derivative song is something that reminds you of something else, but not to the point where you're like, oh, I see what they did there. They got that from, I'll give you an example. There's a song on Black Sabbath's Paranoid album, Rat Salad, which features a drum solo by Bill Ward. I'm like, Moby Dick.
Okay.
It's basically the same template. Or you hear another song by another group, you say, oh, that reminds me of, but as long as it's not to the point where they're just aping it like note for note or like almost, which is almost like sampling in a way. But anyway, getting back to Kiss, yeah, they had their influence. Everybody has influences. Nobody just like wakes up, starts playing guitar and just writes original songs. You have to get your inspiration from somewhere. And these guys, they were listening to the Beatles, the Stones. I know for Paul and Gene, they were heavily influenced by the British groups, Slade and
Right. Ace
so
too.
what's that?
Ace was a big British invasion guy too.
Yeah. How could you? I mean, I can't imagine how you couldn't be back then.
Right, yeah, that's a good
Even
point.
and so like the Beatles, even if you don't like the Beatles, they're influencing you because you're so against them that you'll do anything to not sound like them. So
Yeah.
when you have an impact like that, and of course, we all know that Gene was watching the Ed Sullivan show 50 years, 60 years ago. And when he saw the Beatles and all the girls screaming at them and the fact that his mom disapproved, that put him on the path. I think within a year he had a band of his own. He was playing guitar. And one of my favorite songs off of this album is Let Me Know.
Same.
It's a gem. And what's interesting is that if you've heard any of the live versions from like 73, 74, even 75, they changed it for the studio version because live it just goes Let Me Know and they jam it out, but this has that ending that would later be grafted onto the end of She on Kiss Alive, yeah, I can see we're very musical. We can both sing the guitar riffs, that not very well, but
I can play it too if you want. I might need a
oh
second
really,
to tune up, but yeah.
that's impressive.
These are not
They're not props.
they're no, that if you looked at them closely, they're beat to shit. They're not that great, but that's what I use, so
Hey, you know what? As long as you play, who cares? It doesn't matter if shit, as long as you got the groove and you got the feel for it. Because, in this day and age of like everything being on laptops and samples, it's like musicianship, we need musicians, people who, you can hear the squeak across the fretboard. Years ago, I dabbled in guitar playing. I took lessons. I really didn't practice enough and I didn't stick with it. But I can appreciate what goes into making a song because I've tried to write songs very badly, by the way. But anyway, Let Me Know, it's just a gem. It definitely has that pop side of Kiss, which I've always felt, even when they were quote unquote hard rock or heavy metal, they always had a pop element to them. It would become more pronounced as the years went on, obviously, as they got a little more commercial. But Let Me Know is just a great song. It's just a lot of fun. And I think it was originally called Sunday Driver.
And it very much a lot of the Beatles influence shows up on this record, and that's one of the songs that really comes through. Kind of
Ooh.
has that I don't know, that lighter, it's definitely one of the lighter tunes on here, even with the guitars in it, so
Well, the album cover is basically Meet the Beatles.
yep.
And the funny thing about that, and you've heard the story about how they claimed that the photographer had balloons blown up and said, okay, who's going to hold the balloons? Well, because he thought they were clowns. The photographer, whose name escapes me,
See if
said
I can, I got the
there were no balloons. I think, and as we learned, Gene and Paul have been telling some of these stories for so long that
Joel Brodsky, does that sound right?
Joel Brodsky, yes, that's him. I think they've been telling these stories for so long that they believe them, or they,
Oh, 100%. Yeah, there. Gene has actually gotten narrower as he's gotten older. These are the four things I talk about now, but
Yes, I want to talk about the new Kiss merchandise. That's I wish Ken Mills was here because Ken Mills can do, Gene better than anybody. Yeah, of course there's a Beatles influence. All of them were, I'm pretty sure, were Beatles fans to some degree. I know Gene definitely was. I know with Paul, it was Led Zeppelin was his primary influence.
Yeah, who's that lesser known band that he got? The Move? You like them a lot too.
There's a song that The Move did, and I can't remember the name of it, but if you listen to it, you'll hear Love Her All I Can in it.
Okay.
Like the same kind of chord progression, just again,
Boom,
just
boom,
slightly
boom,
rearranged.
boom.
Yeah, now we have, of course, the infamous love theme from Kiss, because I guess that was the thing back then. Movies had love themes, But of course, we know that's really distilled from a song called Acrobat, which they were doing performing live. That was like the first part, and then it went into this part of the song where it sped up, and where you can hear the pro like a prototype for Detroit Rock City, because it goes da na 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 like. So, as we know, bands like to recycle stuff from their early days or stuff that they never used. And it's not just Kiss. Every band does that.
Yeah, you get an idea that's not fully fleshed out, but you like something a lot, but you just really couldn't pull it together with to make a complete song. And years later, maybe you, hey, what about that thing? Maybe that'll fit here. You know what I mean? That's pretty common.
Well, like Aerosmith came out with this album a couple of years ago. That was a 1971 recording of a rehearsal, and they had "Dream On," and it's pretty close to the original version that we've all heard. But at the end of it, he starts playing this little piano bit. I'm like, wait a minute, that's the beginning to "You See Me Crying" from "Toys in the Attic." So 4 years earlier, they had the beginning of a song, like you just said. Steven Tyler was probably, hey, wait a minute, what about that thing I had, And he just started noodling at the piano and probably wrote it. Yeah, and as we know on the next album, "Going Blind" is a Wicked Lester, recycle. "Love Her All I Can" is She, or also Wicked Lester recycles from that first album that was never released.
Did anything from Wicked Lester end up on this record, the first one?
I don't think so.
Yeah, okay. I didn't really, I mean, I'm just thinking it in the moment here. But I recently got a vinyl pressing of Wicked Lester that has the cover, the boy sitting on the steps. So, it's like a bootleg, but it's the best sounding recording I've ever heard of those things. So I was pleasantly surprised that I overpaid for my stupid collection. But
Wait a minute, you overpaid for something Kiss related?
I'm a recovering Kiss fan, so for me to do something like that now
Oh
is kind of rare. But I was just like, in the moment, I'm like, I'm just gonna do it. Fuck it. I bought it just for the cover, and but thankfully, it sounds amazing too. So that it paid off a little bit. But yeah, I'm actually downsizing my Kiss collection. I have a pinball if you're looking to buy one.
I've been a recovering Kiss fan for like the last 15 years or so.
Yeah, it didn't happen instant, but yeah, I would say probably 2004 on, it just started to wane.
You know what started for me? It started for me in the 2001 when Kiss announced Eric Singer, and they posted the picture of him in Peter's makeup.
Yeah,
That
okay.
was the beginning. Like, it was a slow, it was almost like being in a relationship that just kind of dissolved over time.
this just isn't working for me anymore.
I wasn't, honestly, I wasn't even gonna, I couldn't have cared less about that final concert they had on pay-per-view. I wasn't gonna
Oh,
rent it.
just recently?
Yeah. I wasn't even planning to watch it, but my cousin called me up and said, "Hey, I'm gonna rent the pay-per-view concert. Why don't you come over? We'll hang out. We'll have some dinner, have a couple of drinks." All right, fine. I am so glad I did not pay for that, because honestly, my reaction was not like bad, but it wasn't really good. To me, it was just like a shrug. It did nothing for me. Like, it was just like, this is just them going through the motions, lip syncing.
Yeah, it was lame.
It was.
I probably would have done something like you if I had a friend locally that was like, hey, I'm gonna rent it if you want to come over, help, like just hang out. We talked about
He was pissed too, because like
he spent
the
money
whole
on
well
it.
yeah well because the whole prelude thing was just these interviews with people who I couldn't have cared less about.
Yeah, I watched some of that though on YouTube after the fact. I like the fact that Desmond and Chris Angel were both a little tuned up, not embarrassingly drunk, properly festive for the moment.
But the thing is also, like my cousin's gripe was that it wasn't even in HD. Like, it was almost
Oh, I
like,
did not know that.
no, it
Oh, it
wasn't.
was streaming only too, right? Like, I mean, you couldn't really, you had to cast it to your TV. Then you couldn't watch it like through an actual app on the TV, if I understood it right.
Well, it definitely did not look state of the art.
Okay. Well, real quick on that, though, we actually talked about what it would take for like me and my co-host to actually attend it. And I was like, you would have to give me a paid week vacation in New York, obviously free tickets, wine and dine me. And then, yeah, one of Gene or Paul has to do an hour interview for our podcast. That was the I was like, if I need all that, and then I'll go, I'll watch it. But I could not have been less interested in what they've been doing well before this.
So yeah, I mean, you get Love Theme from Kiss, which is great. Then like they
You
do,
do like it though, huh? You like Love Theme from
I
Kiss?
do,
It's
I like it.
not
I do.
exactly a same here.
It's not like something I would go out of my way to like listen to like on a, you know, like a playlist, but if it comes on, then you have Black Diamond, and they do this weird thing at the end of Black Diamond where they slow it down, slowly slow it down, and to the point where it's like. And I'm telling you, I used to listen to that in my room late at night with the lights out, and I would be like, I'd almost be a little scared. There was something creepy about it.
I love it, man. I'm with you though. It was definitely one of those things. It was kind of like, wow, what's going on here? I love the way at the very end you just hear the tom bump bump just a little bit as it fades.
Yeah, it's just strange, but now I love it. I mean, it's a quirky little thing about the production. Like I said, Koerner and Wise were just not heavy rock producers. You know, they probably made some great pop records for Neil Bogart, you know, who, again, he Casablanca had no money back then, so they had to get whoever they could get to produce it. But, you know, I love this album. I mean, I listened to it, you know, in preparation for this, and I'll tell you, it
Same.
still sounds fresh.
Yeah, say I like it. I was counting too. I think I have 8 copies on vinyl and I got 2 CD copies. I don't think I have a cassette one around here anymore, but I don't know. It's one of those records. I just love it.
It's an evergreen, and like, you know, as we've discussed, you know, this is like 7 of these songs would end up on a live. What does that tell you?
And they were kind of staple songs for their set list in and out, basically till the end.
I mean, Deuce is one of those songs that, you know, I remember on the Destroyer tour, they did it like as the first encore, and it just doesn't work as an encore. It's got to be like
No,
the first,
it's
it's got to be the first or second song of the set. You know, it's got to be.
agreed.
Yeah, because when you try it as like later on, it just, I don't know. But it, again, you know, great album, great songs. I mean, it obviously went on to have a major impact with Kiss. And, you know, even though it wasn't a big seller, they still look back on that album very fondly. They'll be the first ones to tell you that, yeah, most of these songs ended up on Kiss Alive.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. It's a very enjoyable record. It's aged very well, 50 years on, and, you know, we're still talking about it.
Did you see the Kiss Online 50th anniversary merch blob they just dropped?
Oh my God. You know,
It
Gene and Paul have enough money to finance our retirements, our family's
was
retirements. I don't have any kids, but like if you have kids, they could finance your kids' retirements. But they're going to milk it for all it's worth. I think they're just addicted to the fame and the money aspect of it. But I can't wait to go see those avatars live.
Yeah, same. 2027 can't get here soon enough.
By the way, folks, extreme sarcasm on both, you know, our parts here. But you know,
Anybody who listened to our show, I had a friend who I hadn't seen in 6 months, and he hung out with me the day we got together. It just happened to be the day after that news dropped, and he's like, "I was so excited I was seeing you. I had to hear what you thought about the avatars." Like he just knew it was like a, I would think it was a shit show. But anyway.
but you know, again, great album, and you know, this was a lot of fun to do, and I think we should probably reconvene at some point to talk either more about Kiss, or I'm sure there's probably 1,000 other groups we could talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, I can go deep on Kiss, but hard rock and metal in general.
Did you do a podcast on Hot Space by Queen?
I didn't know. Definitely
Okay, I'm confusing. Oh,
not
never mind. But anyway, Baco, where are you on the internet, and where can we find you?
Well, fire up your Google or preferred web searcher and just type in Cobras and Fire podcast. That'll bring you pretty much where you want, or you can type in cobrasandfire.com and that'll give you links to everything, including you can listen to the shows on our website, but anywhere you catch any, if you listen to podcasts anywhere, you can find us typically on all of it. Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, I think Podcast Addict is my preferred one, but we're even on the Evil Empire Spotify. It takes a little more digging,
I thought you were going to say Truth Social.
Yeah, maybe. I guess I'll have to log into an account and see if anybody's sharing us on there. Yeah, so it's pretty easy to find us. We're on Facebook, obviously. We are on Twitter, but Twitter turned to X and things are kind of goofy with that. So I don't just not as very active there. But we have a group called Cobras on Fire. If you're a fan of the show, I encourage anybody to join that group on Facebook because Elsie and I routinely post and share stuff on there and interact with the listeners and friends of that. Plus, we share all the episodes, so it's an easy way to get reminded that it comes out. Every other Tuesday is a new episode of Cobras on Fire.
Nice.
I do a lot of fill-in stuff that kind of covers the off weeks, and sometimes Elsie will do that too. So close to an episode a week, but definitely the regular show is every other week.
And
So.
you may not want to listen to the show around little kids because these guys do not hold
No.
the language and the content. I was even shocked. And I'm hard to shock. But I will
That's encouraging to hear.
Well, yeah, that yeah, because and I will definitely put a link in the show notes for that so that people can tune in and turn on. And just like I said, just be prepared.
Yeah, it's not safe for work. It's not meant for kids. It's very irreverent and off-color humor, but
Your kids will be warped for life, and we can't, they and they may and therapy may not help them.
Yeah, my kids will confirm that just being around me has warped them for life. So,
Baco, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
yeah, Chris, thanks for the invite. I appreciate it. Yeah, we'll definitely have to line up together. I'll get you on our program here at some point too.
I would love that. That would be a lot of fun. So that's our discussion, folks, and we hope you enjoyed it. Before we move on to Hotter Than Hell, another message from our sponsor.
Kiss is hotter than hell. The demons of rock, burning cross country with fire and thunder. Kiss, with a new album that's all
rock and roll!
Kiss, the demons of rock, burning it up in concert and on their new album, Hotter Than Hell. On Casablanca Records and Ampex Tapes. Available wherever records are sold.
And we're here to talk about Kiss's second album of 1974. Of course, I'm referring to Hotter Than Hell. Think about it. Kiss had released their first album only 8 months prior. I mean, this is how bands worked back then, folks. And I'm bringing someone new onto the show to talk about this. We've interacted a lot on the classic rock bottom. How appropriate. Facebook page. Jeff Hoglund, welcome to the show.
Hey Chris, a pleasure to be here. I appreciate you asking me.
Yeah, well, I wanted to bring on some new people, and this is, of course, the 50th anniversary of the first two Kiss albums. So before we get into the conversation, I just wanted to ask you, what was your experience like? When did you first hear Hotter Than Hell, and what was your reaction to it?
Of course, when Hotter Than Hell came out, I was let's see, about 8 years old. So I
Wow.
had no concept of who Kiss was at the time.
Same.
I didn't know about Kiss until fifth grade, I believe I was in. One of my buddies in fifth grade was told me all about this band that was just the greatest band in the world, and that would have been around 76. So it was at least a couple years after this came out. I don't know exactly when I went back and bought this for the first time. I know it was sometime in the late 70s. Bought it on vinyl, of course, at the time. Always have liked it. I think it's a great, great album. To me, a good heavy album. I feel like it's one of their heavier albums. I've always thought that, even though I guess as a kid, I probably didn't know I thought that. So.
Right. Well, the interesting thing for me, I became a Kiss fan pretty much, in 77, like between fifth and sixth grade. So in the fall of 1977, I started buying Kiss albums, and I didn't buy them in any particular order. I just picked this one up, and I liked it. I mean, this was all new to me, so it was very exciting. One thing that's interesting about this record, it tends to divide fans because of the production and the sound, and we'll get into that. But I want to sort of set the stage for Okay, so this album was released on October 22nd, 1974, second album in 8 months, but there was a big difference this time. They recorded this album in California at the Village Recorder in Los Angeles with same producers as the first album, but it was a different studio. They were out of their element. They were like visiting California for the first time. And the two producers, Kenny Koerner and Richie Wise, who had produced, like I said, the first one, wanted to try something different. They wanted to produce a really heavy sounding record, but here's the thing. These guys were not heavy metal producers or hard rock producers. They were pop producers, and they tried a different approach to this record. And I forget which one said this, but it was in an interview, and he said, "Yeah, we kind of messed it up. It really wasn't as good as it could have been." And like I said, Jeff, there are some people who love this album, like you. They love the way it sounds. It's heavy, and there's people who don't like it. Now, I love this album, but I do think the production is on the thin side. But what redeems it for me is the fact that these guys are young and hungry, and they just slam it out. I mean, I listened to this morning. I'm like, you know what? Maybe the production is a little thin. It's kind of dry, but you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way.
I agree. If you ask me what's one thing you might consider changing about it, if you could go back and change something, about the only thing I would change maybe is the tone or the sound of the drum. To me, they sound, I don't really know the right word, almost too much like a trash can. That's a terrible
Yeah.
analogy, but they have that kind of sound. They're nothing like, for instance, my absolute favorite drum sound on any Kiss song is on "Do You Love Me."
Yeah,
The
yeah.
intro to "Do You Love Me" sounds so heavy. With the echo type sound you get with it, it sounds so good to me. But that doesn't mean this record would sound good like that. You go back
Right.
and change it, and it may really not sound any better or as good. It's possible. So.
Well, I suspect, given the way it was recorded, that even in, like, if they remixed it, it may not sound much better or much, you know. And I'm so used to it sounding this way that, in a way, you know what? I don't care if they ever remix it. A lot of people say, "Oh yeah, let's remix it." And here's an example. You know that Kiss did the Destroyer remix back in 2012, right?
That's right.
Do You Love Me? I do not like the way that sounds because they put that reverb on the drums, and it sounds like it's like suspended in air. But on the remix, it's crashing to earth. It's like it just doesn't sound right.
Well, and that's the way they sound on live recordings to me. They just don't have that same pop that they have on the studio album. That
Right.
Ezrin did. I mean, that pop on that album, when that song kicks in, that's some of just the best tone sounding drums I have ever heard.
These guys, like I said, one of them actually admitted in an interview that they messed up, you know, because if you listen to the production on the first album, it's good, you know, it's good production. It's not really heavy, hard rock production, but it's a lot more listenable. And my what if Eddie Kramer had produced this record?
Right.
This album would have sounded amazing because you listen to like Rock and Roll Over. That, in my opinion, is the way Kiss really sounds in the studio. Because, you know, we all know Bob Ezrin kind of overdoes things and he gets involved and he really kind of he becomes almost like the fifth member of the band. Whereas Eddie Kramer's like he gets the levels right. He knows how to record guitars, obviously, because he worked with Hendrix and Led Zeppelin. But yeah, that's my what if. But you know what? This album is the way it is. They did an album of re-recordings about 15 years ago, and they did Hotter Than Hell. Now, of course, they're doing it with Tommy Thayer and Eric Singer. Technically, yeah, it sounded a little heavier, but it did not have the same feel.
Yeah, I have that as well. I have a couple of copies of that. Now, I haven't listened to it probably in 6, 7 years, but I agree. It did have a little bit heavier, I don't even know if I'd call it heavier sound, because really the original to me is extremely heavy. And I think it's the guitars that make
Yeah.
it sound so heavy for me. Almost a grunge sound back in 1974. So,
Well, you know, that's the
new
thing.
grunge now.
Well, I mean, you can go back years later and make a technically better performance, but you cannot capture the vibe of this album.
Not at all.
This album is a heavy vibe. It may not be as heavy as it could be sonically, but you know, you listen to like Got to Choose, the opening, that like ultra reverbed chord. It's like, damn, that's heavy. That's some heavy shit.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, this, like I said, this album, you know, was recorded in California. They were not used to California. I think one of their guitars got ripped off, and, you know, they were kind of fish out of water. And Ace, of course, they made the mistake of renting cars for them and letting Ace take a car. Let's just say that they probably had to pay whatever the cost was for the wrecked car. And of course, they're around California, so you know Peter and Ace are getting into all sorts of, you know, shenanigans with drugs and all that stuff.
Everything you could imagine, I'm sure.
The other thing, too, that was interesting, when they came out with the first album, now, their first album was the first record released by Casablanca, which was started by the late, great, you know, Neil Bogart. When they started out, Casablanca had major label distribution by Warner Brothers, but by this point, there was a falling out with Warner Brothers, so Casablanca was completely independent, and they were just, you know, relying on their own little made-up network of distributors. Now, Casablanca was struggling at this point. The first album sold something like, I think, 150,000, 160,000, which, you know, is not, it's pretty respectable for a new band, but not what probably Casablanca was hoping for. So they rushed him into the studio to put another record out. Now, interestingly enough, right around this time, Casablanca was preparing another project, an unrelated project. It was an album of clips from Johnny Carson Tonight Show. You remember Johnny Carson, of course, right?
Certainly. Absolutely.
Well, they had compiled this record of great clips from The Tonight Show, all the best of Johnny Carson, and they were convinced that this record, Casablanca, was convinced this record was going to be a massive hit. It was a massive dud. They shipped like 500,000 copies, and because of the way the return policies were, because you could return stuff if you didn't sell it to the record company, the joke was that it was the first album that shipped gold and returned platinum.
See, I thought that honor went to the four solo albums.
Well, that too, but that's another story. We actually covered that last year. But the thing is, this put Casablanca like at a, you know, they were almost bankrupt at one point, and they, you know, they were going to almost have to pull the plug, and Kiss would have been up the creek. But somehow Neil Bogart, because he was kind of like part genius and part con man, he somehow convinced, he kept things going somehow. But meanwhile, Kiss is trying to push this album, and this album doesn't do, if it does any better, it's not much better than the first album. They're really pushing this album. But if you see any of the live clips from this period, especially there's one out there on YouTube, Winterland 1975, it's in black and white. They are killing it live.
Well, I have, speaking of that, I have a couple of bootlegs from that time period, bootlegs on CD. And you're right. I mean, Ace, I tell you, Ace is so spot on with his solos in the early days. And Peter, I mean, his drumming, he was a really, really great drummer.
He was.
And I don't know, you know, obviously what happened along the way somewhere, and I'm sure he can still drum, but I don't think he can do it like he did when he started. But he was a hell of a drummer.
You know, it's funny, like people say, oh, he wasn't a good drummer. We know he was. He was, the funny thing was, he was not a traditional rock drummer. He came from like a jazz background.
That's right.
He liked rock and roll, obviously, he liked the Beatles and the Stones, but he was trained by Gene Krupa, who was this big jazz drummer. And, you know, the one thing that people or Kiss fans know, Peter had a certain swing to his style, and it made them sound unique. With, you know, you can say what you want about Ace and Peter. They did this, they did that, but man, they were killing it. They were all hungry. Gene and Paul like to put them down and say they didn't contribute. Bullshit. We know that's not true.
That's right.
The proof is right here. The only thing that I think that does a disservice is that the drums weren't really recorded properly or mixed properly.
Yeah, they just have that weird sound to me. But if you break it down and you're not necessarily listening to the sound, but you're listening to what he's actually doing on the drums, I mean, he is really on top of it. And some of it sounds to me, now I'm not a drummer. I've never been a drummer. I love the sound of drums, but I don't know anything about them except when they sound good to my ears. For instance, if you put on a song by somebody and all they do is double bass drum through the whole song, it just drives me bonkers. I can't stand it. It's way too much. But what Peter was doing on this album, I also listened to it this morning to kind of refresh my memory. Yeah. As well, and some of the stuff seems to me like it's fairly complex what he's doing.
Yeah,
and some of his fills and his drum rolls are just, I mean, in Parasite, the drum roll he has in Parasite is just amazing.
His fills were just very inventive and like very unconventional for a rock band, and that's But that's why I think Kiss, the original Kiss, worked together so well, because you had these four guys who are from, they might as well have been from different planets, no pun intended for Ace, but they, when they came together, even Paul, and you know, said when they got together for the first time in New York City, they knew that was the sound. And whatever Ace and Peter did, they were willing to put up with it because they knew that this band was going to kick ass. I mean, you've got like, and you've got some songs on here, like say something like Going Blind, which is actually a holdover from the Wicked Lester days, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, it's interesting because I'm 93, you're 16. Like, and even Gene has said, I don't know what the hell I meant by writing that song.
It's funny that you mentioned that specific song, because that's my favorite song on the album. I absolutely love that song, and it is weird. The lyrics are weird. I love that they brought back, I think it was the Unplugged show, yes, when they brought back the one of the original lyrics, you know.
Little Lady from Little the Land Beneath the Sea.
Yeah, Beneath the Sea, that's right. I loved hearing that because I've always heard it the other way, obviously, and it was really neat to hear that. But that song is so great, and Ace's solo on that song is just, his solos across the whole album are just very impressive, very impressive.
When they did the Unplugged and they were bringing back all these obscure songs, in a way, like, when they did the reunion the following year, it was great, but in a way, like, that was kind of the end of an era where you had a Kiss with, you know, Bruce Kulick and Eric Singer, where they could just kind of bring these obscure songs back and really do them justice.
Yeah, and they were really good. I mean, I'm sure that's really a different show. Talking about them leaving the band or having to leave the band, it was a really good lineup when they got to that time. But they really did. And hearing these bootlegs of the convention tour and stuff are just great. It's great to hear them.
Well, one of the other songs on this album, "Coming Home," is the leadoff track on Unplugged. And as far as I'm concerned, I actually prefer the Unplugged version.
It's great, and it's got the high backing vocals, I think, is what makes that song really kick to me. I mean, the whole song's great anyway, but
I just think it sounds better Unplugged, because, you know, on the studio version, it's like, it's good, but there's something about the Unplugged version that takes it to another level. And, you know, after the once they got back together in the makeup with Ace and Peter, we were never going to go back to that experimental era where they could just do obscure songs. They had to do the hits. They had to do the stuff from the first six or seven albums. But this, you know, this album, I mean, you know, Hotter Than Hell. I mean, Let Me Go Rock and Roll. Let Me Go Rock and Roll is one of those songs that, like, that was in their live set for years.
That's right. That actually closes the bootleg I was referring to earlier. That's the closer.
I mean, you know, you've got Parasite, which is one of Ace's greatest riffs. And what's interesting about the Hotter Than Hell version, the solo, Ace's solo, like the first part of it, sounds so unusual. It almost sounds like a country, like, guitar, if that makes any sense.
Huh. I'd have to listen to it again fresh and have that on my mind to see if I agree with that.
It just sounds different. Like, there's some, and Ace never replicated that sound, like, live. You know, he just did it in a more conventional style, but it almost sounds like he's doing, like, a country rock kind of thing. And then, of course, he just goes into a regular kind of, you know, Jimmy Page type solo, which, of course, you know, the guys in Kiss were all big Led Zeppelin fans, and as well they should be. But yeah, I mean, this album just kicks ass. Like I said, whatever sonic deficiencies it may have or may not have, you can't deny that these guys were just, you know, kicking ass, and like, it was like ferocious. Like, they were grabbing you by the throat and saying, you're ours and you're going to listen to this.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I really think one of the unsung songs of the album is All the Way. Kind of forgotten about, I think, you know, but I haven't forgotten about it. I did for a while. And when I went back to it, I thought, man, I really remember loving this song back when I first got the album. And I still do. It's just so great. But it really doesn't get any attention like some of the other songs. All the songs are great. If you ask me which song might be the weakest on there, it'd probably be Mainline. But I like Mainline. I'm not saying it because I don't like it. I still love it. It's just probably, from a songwriting aspect, probably about the weakest one on there.
Well, I think that was, I don't know if Peter wrote that or not, but they obviously wanted to throw Peter a bone, so they let him do that. And it's a good pop song, if you really think about it.
I mean, it's catchy. It's got a great little chorus.
And as you know, as heavy as Kiss might have been during this period, they always had a pop element to their songwriting. All of them at one point wrote really good pop songs. That would become a little more pronounced later on, especially as the production became a lot more homogenized and pop and disco and all that stuff. But you know, it's just a good album cut. I mean, you know, like you said, yeah, it probably is the weakest song on the record, but who, you know, it's still a good song. When you're generating two albums in the same year, you can't have like every song be the best song in the world. I mean, even Destroyer has one or two filler tracks if you really analyze it.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And by the way, it was Paul that wrote Mainline.
Okay. But you
Yeah.
know, but then you have like the end of it where, okay, Strange Ways, where Ace wrote the song and they tried to get Ace to sing it, but he just didn't want to do it. He was too shy or whatever. So they gave it to Peter, and who does a great job with it. But there's an interesting story behind that. Peter Chris demanded that during Strange Ways, he get to do an extended drum solo.
Yes, I've read about this.
And he said he would leave the band if he could do it. So they recorded him doing this big drum solo, and they just told the engineers, or the engineers decided to cut it out. Peter never mentioned said a word about it. They called his bluff, because what was he going to do? Quit the band and what? Go back to New York and play in a bar?
Right.
At least they were on a major label and they had distribution, even though they weren't really selling a lot of records and making money. I mean, if anything, you know, they were on a, you know, they could have gone under at any time because Casablanca couldn't afford to pay them the royalties that they were making. They were an opening act, and the problem was they were so good that a lot of groups didn't want them opening for them.
Right. And Peter was doing a lot better in the band than he would have been anywhere else. But wouldn't you love to hear that version of that song now, though? Just to hear it, since it's been talked about so much.
You know, it's unfortunately Hotter Than Hell is not an album that sold a lot, so it's doubtful we're ever going to get the big Hotter Than Hell deluxe box set. You know, with Peter's, you know, 7-minute drum solo, it's like that. I think that would have killed the momentum of that album.
Oh, it probably would have. It probably would have really messed it up, and they probably made the right decision, but I'd still love to hear it.
Oh, of course. And you know, Peter, like, I guess from day one was just difficult. You know, like he wanted, you know, he I guess he was one of those people who was just miserable all the time and just inflicted it on everybody.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, well, if you ever did you ever read his book?
I did. I've read all their books. It's been a while, but I have read them all.
As one person called Peter's book "Live to Whine." You
That's
know, everything in
perfect.
his life is like bad, and he blames it on everybody else.
We all know well, at least one or two people like that.
Tell me about it. Tell me about it, Curly.
There you go.
Yeah, you know, but again, it's the combination of these guys together that made this album what it was. And in a way, I mean, yeah, would I be curious to hear a remix of it? Yeah, but I have a feeling that even if they were able to make it sound a little heavier or clear it up a little bit, it wouldn't be the same.
I don't think so, and I don't. It'd be something that'd be neat to have sitting on your shelf with all your other stuff. But when it came down to picking one copy to listen to, I mean, I think probably both of us would pick the original copy.
Yeah, because that's the one you grew up with. That's the one that's embedded in your brain.
That's right.
And as you know, the stuff you hear as a kid tends to imprint itself because that's the stuff that you first heard, and that's going to be your go-to.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I still listen to new music now, but it does not put itself on my brain like the stuff back then did. I mean, that's the stuff you set up, at night, put your headphones on, just laid on the floor next to your record player or your tape player or whatever, and listen to them over and over.
You could pro you know, you or I could hear the greatest song in the world tomorrow by a new band, and it wouldn't have the same impact.
Not at all.
Because when you're young and you're a kid, you're a teenager, whatever, you're very passionate about your music. I mean, I took my music a lot more seriously back then. Like, it was like if you insulted Kiss, it'd be like, screw you, I'll rip your heart out, you know?
That's right.
And especially Kiss fans back in the late 70s, I mean, we were like this, you know, the Kiss Army, but I mean, it was more like we were committed to you know, like it was a cause. It was a thing. And anybody who didn't like Kiss or put them down for their makeup. I mean, now you kind of look back on it and you can kind of see the silliness to a certain extent, especially like as they went into like stuff like Kiss Meets the Phantom and Dynasty. But, you know, this, like, Hotter Than Hell, like the one thing I love about that video we were talking about, Winterland 1975, that it's in black and white. And I saw someone tried to colorize it on YouTube. I'm like, no, leave it in black and white. It's much more affecting that way.
That's right. That's how you see it too in your brain. I mean, so at least that's how I would see early Kiss. I can't see, because that's the only thing I've ever seen when I have seen early Kiss is black and white. So.
Right. And then, and you've got a song like Watching You, which, you know, on this album is real, is good, but like when it's live, it's actually a lot more ominous and a lot more disturbing.
Right. I agree with that.
I think, like, honestly, like Hotter Than Hell, I think the live version is much better than this. It's a lot, it's not as stiff. It's got a little more, it's got more heaviness to it, because obviously Eddie Kramer, you know, engineered that and supervised the, you know, post-production, you know, overdubbing and whatever.
Right. I was listening to, or I'm sorry, I was talking to my friend Scott the other day, and his favorite version of Parasite is the live 75 version from Alive. He said that song sounds just so heavy on the live version.
And that confirms to me like what this album would have been if Eddie Kramer had produced it.
Just that heavier sound that just sound like you're sitting in the room watching them perform it.
Right. Like I said, he knew how to record guitar players. He worked with Hendrix. He worked on some Beatle recordings, Led Zeppelin. He, you know, to me, he's one of those guys. He sets up the mics, gets the sound right, and says, okay, guys, let it roll. He's not like Bob Ezrin trying to tell them, okay, you need to arrange the song this way or record it this way. And, you know, Paul Stanley has said that he thinks Bob Ezrin is more of a producer because he can suggest, you know, musical change. Bob Ezrin is obviously a musician and a classically trained musician, whereas I don't think Eddie Kramer was. I mean, I think he played a little piano, but he was not one to say, okay, let's rearrange this. But we'll never know. I mean, I know that part of the reason why they didn't have Eddie Kramer on the first couple of Kiss records was because they couldn't afford, Casablanca couldn't afford to pay him that much.
Right. They didn't have any money back then, so.
The first 2 years were like, it was touch and go. They could have gone under at any time. You know, Neil Bogart was wheeling and dealing. Speaking of that, have you seen the movie Spinning Gold?
I have not. I would like to watch it. I have not seen it yet.
Like most docudramas of, you know, like that, and even Bohemian Rhapsody, it plays a little fast and loose with the facts sometimes, and it shuffles time periods around. But I, generally speaking, I enjoyed it.
Well, my brain shuffles time periods around pretty much all the time, so I think it fit right in for me.
If you know the history, you might be going, well, this didn't happen, but you'd have to just forget about that. And of course, the Kiss makeup is not exactly on model, because they probably would have gotten sued if they had.
Probably so, yeah. They had to adjust it a little bit.
So they, you know, they play fast and loose, but it's an enjoyable movie. And I mean, it's one of those things, if you know anything about the history of Casablanca Records, they were doing probably more drugs than some of their artists were.
That's what I've read.
Well, yeah, I mean, you'd go to a Casablanca back in the 70s and people would be having, you know, sex on, you know, desks and snorting cocaine. And they're like, that was encouraged. I mean, the boss liked that because he was doing it.
Right. Could you imagine going to work and all that going on?
I'd never want to leave. No, I'm kidding. I wouldn't really be into the drug so much, but I mean, I can't imagine anybody went home at night and said, oh, I had what a day, man. I can't stand that place.
That's right. It's just a hard day at work.
Yeah. I mean, you know, having a secretary bent over the desk and, you know, snorting a line with her or whatever. But, you know, of course, that ultimately Casablanca went under because of that, because, you know, even when they started having hits and Kiss started, you know, selling a lot of records, they were spending so much that eventually it caught up with them. But that's, you know, that's further on down the line. But this, you know, this is a great album. This is just something that holds up to this day. And I don't know. I mean, I think I pretty much said what I wanted to say about it. Do you have anything else you want to say, Jeff? Or,
well, just in general, I actually just purchased a used copy of this album on CD, but I had to get the I wanted to get the non-remastered one.
Oh, you don't want that one.
Well, I want it. I'm not saying I'll listen to it any more okay. than I'll listen to this one, but I bought that. I had it before, and like a dummy, I sold it. I should have just kept all my non-remastered copies when I sold them all. But now I'm going back through the catalog and kind of every once in a while adding a non-remastered back to it. The only other thing that really stands out to me, and this is really not necessarily about the album itself, is the with the albums, the LPs, the vinyl. Back in the days, I could not figure out why my album had a tan label and my cousin's album had the blue label. And I thought the blue label was so cool and sounded so much better than my tan label, even though I'm sure they pretty much sounded the same at the time.
No, I can tell you why. And your blue label probably did sound better. There's a reason for that. You said you had a different color label, right?
Right. Mine was the tan Casablanca label, which, and of course I know why now, but as a kid, I had no idea, why he had a different looking label than I had, but I always thought his was cooler. And when we held up that Hotter Than Hell album, it just looked better. Any of them did with that blue label.
You got a later pressing.
That's right. That's right.
Some of those early pressings were worked on, every time they go to recut an album, like they have to like produce a new master because album masters, or they call it stampers, wear out after I think 5,000 copies. So you probably had a later pressing that wasn't as good.
Okay. I'm sure that's what it was. I know my pressing was the later pressing. Of course, he was a couple, 2 or 3 years older than me, Yeah. So he probably got to it a lot sooner than I did. So,
and I know you've already bought it, but I would advise anybody listening to not buy the original CD, because there are some tracks on there that have glitches on it. Like they sound like white noise or like scratching. I think at the time they didn't use the right master tape. I think they just took whatever was on hand. They corrected that for the remastered CD. So like I said, your mileage may vary, but I would advise anybody, don't buy the original Hotter Than Hell CD because it does not sound very good.
Well, I'll definitely be listening to it right after I get it, just to see how it sounds.
And that's not the only CD. Alive and Alive 2 also have the same glitches on them. Like I said, it's white noise and it sounds scratchy. And I remember being pissed because back then, you were paying $15 for a CD in 1988 money.
That's right. That's right.
But, again, a great album. And, I appreciate you coming on, Jeff, and talking about this.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's a new experience for me, but I enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
I always like listening to you because you got a lot of knowledge up there in that noggin.
Well, I have a head full of useless knowledge, but it appeals to somebody, which I'm glad you enjoy the show. I'm glad you listen because, I don't promote the show probably as much as I should. I'm just not that way. So when people do, reach out to me and say, hey, I really enjoyed it, it's like, okay, I'm going to keep doing this,
There you go. Yeah, that makes you feel like it's worth your time and effort. You're doing it because you like to do it anyway.
This is the easy part of it, talking. The hard part is going back in and editing, which takes, almost three times as long because you've got to cut out glitches and stuff like that. But you know what? It's worth it. And Jeff, this was a lot of fun. I want to have you back sometime. Obviously, with Classic Rock Bottom, which, of course, references a Kiss song, there's a lot of stuff we could talk about. I definitely want to have you back sometime.
All right, buddy. I appreciate it.
Yep. And with that, we end this conversation of Hotter Than Hell in this episode of Mr. K Super Show. We'll see you next time when we'll talk about something else.
You've been listening to Mr. K Super Show.
If you like what you heard, please share it on social media and anywhere and everywhere on the interwebs. Thank you for listening to Mr. K's Super Show.